And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Vincent Freeman from the Carnicom Institute, carnicominstitute.org, and his personal website is biocode.info. We have a lot more questions to try to get to here to try to understand a little bit better about what we're talking about here, what this means, you know, getting to who and some of the why potentialities later of how this might be used and everything else. It's a huge mystery here, obviously, but at the same time, there's so much work being done on this now, both by Vincent and Clifford as well, which is encouraging in that regard. But I know you wanted to just talk a little bit more about the term Morgellons, because, I mean, that in itself is a kind of a misnomer a little bit, because for one, this is not a recognized, you know, disease or symptom even to a certain extent. But then, you know, on top of that, there's a kind of a language thing as well. So is there any other term you'd prefer to use for some of this instead?
That's a great question. You know, it's a popular term, and I don't know if any of my efforts are going to make it go away. No, I don't have a term yet. I'm sort of experimenting with terms. And a good example of a new term that Clifford had coined would be the cross-domain bacteria, because before that he was calling them all sorts of different, you know, something like forms, chlamydia-like forms, but with cross-domain bacteria, now we have a good name for them until, you know, we prove it wrong. With Morgellons, the problem with that partially is that I believe the original condition goes back, at least 100 years, maybe more, and it originally was described to something completely different than it is now, and so the term was sort of reused, and also it's just, it has a lot of baggage associated with it. Especially because the CDC said it was a hoax for many years and said the people suffering it from it were crazy. And then they conducted a study for several years by scientists who were definitely on the payroll. I can personally vouch for that. So it wasn't a real study. It was totally rigged. And then at the end of it, they said, they're just, you know, nylon fibers or whatever they were. So just with all that baggage, and also the speculation about it, it doesn't really help describe it. So almost it's more, I would say it's more like a syndrome, right? Medically, it's a constellation of symptoms, but we're not really sure the cause. We can connect it back with the aerosol spraying through a few different mechanisms, but we don't really know why some people manifest Morgellons and why some don't. And so in that sense, it's almost, whether it's genetic or environmental or some, who knows, it's more of a syndrome or something like that. So a good example there is AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. It was called that before the discovery of the HIV virus, and they called it a syndrome because they weren't sure what was causing it. So Morgellons, I don't know what the term for it is. Maybe somebody out there creative can come up with a good name, but I would say it's some sort of syndrome, and you know, we'll try to think of a better name to describe it and to do justice to the people that suffer from it. But yeah, the terminology is important, and even chemtrails. You know, I know Clifford is not a fan of that word, and I'm not so much a fan either. But you know, because it indicates that they're chemicals. Well, They're not chemicals. There's some chemicals in there, but there's also biologicals in there, and there's probably other things we haven't even found. So that's the problem with language, is that, you know, it's kind of used as a way to distract or misdirect, or you can have two people talking about two different things using the same word. So that's sort of my thoughts on the language, but we'll have to work on that and come up with some better terms for all of this.
Well, exactly. Now, is there anything that suggests then that the Morgellons syndrome is a side effect of, you know, of this kind of cross-domain bacteria, that it's something that it's, you know, producing in its trait, or again, it's something it needs? Is there any clearer connection found there yet?
I do believe so. And, you know, I don't have I haven't done the research review to prepare for this, but I do believe that that Clifford has done research to connect these two. So in terms of specifics, I would direct you to the Carnicom Institute's paper catalog. But I could actually read this. Let's see. Well, let's see. I don't have it up. But basically, I would say that Morgellons is it's there's evidence that it is from an environmental source, right?
Right.
And then we have this, infection, this sort of infectious disease with the fibers and the cross-domain bacteria that are from what appears to be the same environmental source. So we have a commonality, but I don't think we're at the point where we have strong circumstantial evidence, but I'm not sure that there is absolute proof that Morgellons is directly linked. Now, I may be mistaken by that, and I'm not familiar with that area, so I would direct anyone not to listen to me, but to go through those papers and look for the evidence. And of course, I could find it and post it on my site if somebody's interested. But then, in terms of the broader question as to what is Morgellons, I could tell you that to me, my personal opinion, it seems to be a higher order manifestation of this core form. So if I were just to make an educated guess, I'd say we have this aerosol, and it's got these fibers, it's got some heavy metal salts and so forth. And then, we also have the organism, and it's in Clifford's papers, can make synthetic erythrocytes, which are red blood cells, and synthesize them inside the filaments. So that tells me that it's sort of, in a way, designed to go in through the lungs. And so we inhale this in, and we get, these cross-domain bacteria in the blood, and then we get filament networks in our tissue. And these are the not the Morgellons filaments, but more the keratin encased, or these small, much smaller filaments that are usually not colored.
Right.
And then some subset of the population then gets these Morgellons, lesions and fibers that are coming out. But what I can tell you, though, that I just recall in terms of evidence. So that's the first thing, is that my opinion is that Morgellons is a higher order manifestation. And if you look at Sophia Smallstorm's presentation, you have at the bottom of the nanotech pyramid, you have, I think, materials. And as you go up, you get like processes and then devices. So I think Morgellons is more of like devices in the nanotech pyramid. So I think that's a much later or higher order or more complex structure. But one interesting circumstantial piece of evidence I can tell you is that people have done analysis on these Morgellons fibers, and they've come back containing very, very strange elements that you wouldn't expect in like a piece of cotton or a piece of nylon. We'd see things like very high amounts of sulfur, very high amounts of aluminum, very high
Aluminum.
amounts, yeah, aluminum, or very high amounts of strontium. And it depends on the sample. All the fibers seem to be a bit different, but they also contain carbon and oxygen, as well as these transition metals or heavy metals. And some of them have, I can't speak off the top of my head to every single one, but
Sure,
those are
yeah.
the ones that I recall. And I think we've seen barium and strontium in there too. And that's using something called energy dispersive spectroscopy, which is basically sort of like a beam that you beam at it, and then from there you can find out what elements are in it and at what percentage. And so we know in the Morgellons fibers, that the colored type fibers, that there are all sorts of elements that would not normally be in there, like that there's lots of sulfur and lots of strontium, barium. Some of them maybe you'd have lead in them. So that may be one explanation for why they keep spraying, is because things like strontium and barium and lead are not exactly floating around in the air. So if it needs it for growth, that it's got to get it from somewhere.
Right. So it's a synthetic can we is it a synthetic thing? Is it something that can anything grow like that naturally out of the body? How do we classify it?
That's a great question. I don't think so, and I think that part of it I would refer back to like Google Scholar, which is a great tool, and you can get full text papers all the way back before 1900, and there's nothing in the literature talking about this sort of thing. So, and just from the analysis that there, I could categorically say there is no natural process that's going to produce fibers like this that are I'm talking about Morgellons fibers now, that are resistant to degradation, that are fluorescent, that contain carbon, oxygen, as well as various heavy metals. I mean, that means that it's a very complex structure, possibly even sort of almost a crystalline lattice within the fiber. So I would say categorically it can't be natural. And like I said, that is, you know, one link of many links between Morgellons and the aerosols, is that the Morgellons later, you know, stage of this that some people get, and not everybody, in fact, probably a minority, you know, less than 50% of the public, obviously.
Sure.
Whatever the process is, that they're excreting these fibers that contain a lot of the elements that seem to come, especially the trace elements you would not be able to get from your diet. They contain those. So they had to come from somewhere. Where'd they get them? You know, the most logical explanation is they inhaled that raw material. But there's other explanations as well. But that's just another link to show Morgellons is linked with this whole life cycle. But I'd refer for the details on the evidence on that. I go to the Carnicom website.
Yep. Now, it might even be an unexpected side effect, some kind of reaction within the body, or again, working in unison with some of these smaller, bacteria/nano, you know, controlled little mini bots, you know what I mean?
Sure. That's one thing that's a big question. And, one odd question is whether it's a genetic thing, whether some people have a genetic mutation. And I know at one point the NIH posted something about a chromosome 1 abnormality. And I think essentially it was a region of human chromosome 1 that was duplicated, and they listed it as with the search term Morgellons. And then somebody linked to it, it went a little bit viral, and they deleted it. And now it's only available on, you know, archive.org or whatever. So, you know, there may be a genetic component that some people have a genetic mutation, which makes them, for whatever reason, through to whatever interaction that we don't understand, produce these fibers. And the more frightening X-Files explanation is that we all are producing the fibers at some level internally, the Morgellons fibers. It's just that in some people, they're manifesting as skin lesions. But I don't think we can get a definitive answer at this point, at least not yet. So I would definitely say, and I'm pretty confident, that the Morgellons is a higher order manifestation of things like these cross-domain bacteria. Then we get filaments, and these filaments seem in the microphotographs, they're releasing erythrocytes. We have those bacteria in the blood. And then, you know, I think through whatever syndrome or process, you know, the Morgellons fibers are produced. And I think they're very closely linked, but exactly how, we don't know. So that's a good question. But I do think it has to do with transhumanism, sort of the merging of man and machine and done covertly. And that's my personal opinion. And I have to, you know, give credit to Sophia for being the first person that I know of to come out and say that in public. And I think she's right. I think that's something that's happening. I think that the Morgellons, I think, is got a lot to do with transhumanism. Huh. I think it's less to do with a reaction. I mean, it may have to do with the organism and some people's genetics, whatever was supposed to happen went wrong and they get lesions with fibers. But the original purpose, I think, regardless of whether Morgellons is an accident or an oversight on the part of whoever created this, the core purpose, I do believe, is transhumanism and essentially planetary GMO, almost like controlling the genetic expression and the evolution of all species on the planet.
Yeah, because we don't know, again, what they might have a passive role, if you will, at the current mode of operation, but at some stage, at some part of the process here, they might be activated, and we've certainly heard the speculations about the nanobots, what they might be doing in the future of you know, getting in and repairing things in the body and all these kinds of, you know, quote unquote, wonderful things that they're promising us that they will be able to do with it. But this could be basically a version of that, but nonetheless, it might have a very detrimental effect on the human body, human tissue, right?
Right. Absolutely. This is a version of that, in my opinion. The closest thing that I have seen with what I know to a nanobot has been these cross-domain bacteria, you know, in terms of the way that they form and assemble and resist and are able to construct, where it seems, construct tissue and change form and all of this. So I do think that technology is here. It's just that when people think of nanobots, they think of a tiny little robot. But in reality, everybody's life process, your cells, they are nanobots, really.
Right.
I mean,
yep.
They're just made out of stuff that was already here for however long, for somewhere between, you know, 4,000 years to millions of years, depending on who you ask. But, you know, like they, you know, that so biology itself is almost like nanobots. It's just a matter of, you know, who's driving the evolution, right?
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You're right. It's very interesting. We'll see if we can get more into that later. But so far, it's only in when it's humans concerned, it's only in the blood of humans so far that these have been found as well, correct? There's no other tissue or anything like that have been examined?
Blood as well as, we're not sure exactly the tissue. It appears to be the gums.
Oh, okay.
And
that's right.
That was this whole red wine spit test. You can take, you know, red wine, I guess probably about, 15 milliliters to 20 milliliters, I think would be around 3 or 4 tablespoons, if I remember right. And then add a little bit of hydrogen peroxide to that, you know, maybe one part hydrogen peroxide. You swish it around in your mouth, you spit it out, and it's filled with these fibers. And if you put it under the microscope, they're the same fibers. They have the same spectral characteristics in the analysis machines as the fibers that are sprayed. So we have positive identification and what it appears to be saliva/gum tissue, specifically gum tissue, as well as in the blood. But we're expecting to find it elsewhere, considering it's in the food we eat too.
Huh.
But, you know, I the evidence isn't there yet, but I suspect we will find it, you know, that we'll find it in other organs in the body. So that's what I expect.
And there's nothing else they could explain, because I know when you use hydrogen peroxide, depending on, you know, it can really kind of, you know, foam up, if you will, in certain, you know, on certain materials and stuff. When you clean with and stuff like that, you can really see that. And is there anything like that that could explain the formulation of those fibers, or it's certain that it's something that actually is coming out of the body of the human that does that?
That's a great question. Yeah, there is certain precipitates that can form. The peroxide is not required for this process, although it does help seem to yield the fibers. The process seems to have to do with the pink pigments in the wine, which is and probably the ethanol. But the pigments are called, I think, anthocyanins or anthocyanins, which are colored pigments that have complex structure, and they seem to sort of pull the fibers out of the gums. So yeah, there is the question, you know, well, could this just be, you know, something that, you know, is a natural precipitate? Because natural precipitates do form when you swish your mouth out or bits of food or whatever. But the problem with this is that it happens even if you, say, brush your teeth and get a very clean mouth and you don't use hydrogen peroxide. And then we take the yield that comes out, these little pieces of almost looks like fibrous reddish material. We take those and we put them in a scientific instrument like a spectrophotometer. And both in the visible range and in the infrared range, which are two different types of analysis, they both come back as almost an exact match to the fiber samples that have come off trees 10 years ago. So there's really just, I mean, that evidence is very strong to link that to the atmospheric aerosol. So unfortunately, although I wish, and the first time I did the test, you know, I wished it was something else, but after just, you know, looking at the data, it's just too compelling. It's definitely, you know, this fibrous material is the same in some sense, in a lot of senses, it's very, very, it's almost an identical spectral match to the environmental filaments that come down from the air. So, you know, so yeah, so I wish it was different, but it seems to be the facts there.
Now, could this these findings give us a potential hint about how we might be able to purge, i.e. detox something like this from the body?
Well, I'll go ahead and offer the standard Carnicom Institute disclaimer, which is that I'm not a medical doctor and I'm not offering medical advice.
Yeah.
Neither is the Carnicom Institute. With that out of the way, you know, so that in dishes, in, you know, petri dishes as you have it, it seems that the growth of the CDB is inhibited by a couple of things, in particular vitamin C, and as well as glutathione. Glutathione is like your body's, it's a sulfur-containing compound, and it's the body's almost like trash can, if you will, and it's like a super trash can. It mops up any sort of toxins or molecules in the body. And for example, if somebody overdoses on acetaminophen in the hospital, it is glutathione. They administer N-acetylcysteine, which produces glutathione, and that's actually what saves people from liver failure. So it's sort of a internal detoxifier. But in the dish anyway, that seems to inhibit the CDB from doing anything. It doesn't kill them, but it prevents them really from functioning, it seems. And the second is vitamin C. And you can refer to the papers at a particular concentration, or ascorbate, ascorbic acid, or sodium ascorbate. That also seems to have the same property. And they seem somewhat synergistic, glutathione and vitamin C. So there are already avenues that could be explored in terms of research. And just one thing in terms of vitamin C, there are precedents for that. Most every mammal besides humans manufacture vitamin C.
Yep.
Humans and guinea pigs are the only ones that don't.
That's funny. So, isn't that bizarre, by the way?
Yeah, it is.
How did that happen, you know?
It actually happened because we lost a enzyme in a chain. So there's a chain of, like, I don't know, whatever it is, 10, 12 enzymes that make it. And one of them, we have it, but it's broken. And so so that's why we don't make it. Huh. But, you know, in studies with people with cancer and so forth, intravenous vitamin C at high doses, say around 50 grams. Again, this is not a suggestion for cancer therapy. Talk to your doctor. But in case studies, I've seen lots of evidence that vitamin C can kill cancer cells through a reaction with catalase, which is an enzyme in them. So it's, you know, in general, vitamin C, I mean, it's water soluble. It's very non-toxic. It's good for you.
Yep,
and
yep.
In the dish, it seems to inhibit the CDB from doing much. And then glutathione, again, you know, that's used to detoxify your body. Let's say if you're a cigarette smoker, or if you get toxins in you in terms of chemical or drug toxins, or, you know, byproducts of pills that you eat, like, you know, byproducts of acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, byproducts of that are detoxified by glutathione. So those are, you know, two promising therapies. The problem is glutathione is not, it doesn't, you can't just eat it as a pill. It's not bioavailable orally. You have to take something like a precursor called N-acetylcysteine, which then replenishes glutathione. And then for vitamin C, your gut will only absorb 5 or 10 grams in a day. So in the cancer therapy, it's an intravenous infusion, slow intravenous of like 50 grams, 100 grams. So, you know, there's that hurdle as well, you know, in terms of getting enough of it in you to have an effect. But those are all avenues for research. And if anyone is out there that's a medical doctor, you know, please contact me, because we would love to, you know, to try to fuse this research, you know, and get it out to the medical community. But at this point, it's just, you know, in a dish. We can't really, you know, take it to the medical level.
Right, exactly. It's very much different in that regard, how to do it. But nonetheless, are there any estimations on what amount we're talking about of to inhibit the growth process? And again, I'm not asking that so someone, you know, runs out and try to, you know, make their body into that petri dish, but nonetheless, yeah. You know, although vitamin C, as you said, is, I mean, it's harmless. I mean, Linus Pauling does some fantastic work on vitamin C and healing people from cancer. So, I mean, that's not an issue there, you know?
Yeah, he's great. You know, he was really, derided in his time, but he, you know, it turns out that, you know, a lot of what he said was correct. It turned out to be correct. Well, based on Clifford's research, there's a paper called Growth Inhibition Confirmed, Morgellons Growth Inhibition Confirmed from March 15th, 2010. And if we look at that, the inhibition was achieved by 1 mg/ml of ascorbic acid. And that's the concentration. Equating that out to a person, which Clifford does in the paper, and again, he's very sensitive about this. This is, again, not medical advice, but equating this 1 mg/ml ascorbic acid, translating to a human body, roughly 70 kilograms, this translate to a single dosage of approximately 70 grams. Now, the problem with that is that that's in excess of what you could ingest in a single day. Because more than about 5 or 10 grams would go right through your gut. But in cancer patients, in the case studies using vitamin C for cancer, the vitamin C infusions are around 50 to 100 grams, sometimes even more, 150 grams. So the fact that it's 70 grams indicates that certainly via the IV route, that could be achieved. And that's actually... using the entire human body, if we were to normalize it for the concentration just in blood and not, you know, tissue that's not, you know, that doesn't have blood that's, you know, whatever, made out of structural proteins and whatever else is responsible for the total weight of the body, it could be a little bit less. So the answer to that question is 1 mg/ml ascorbic acid inhibits the growth, and translating that to a human is a single dose, approximately 70 grams, give or take. So that, again, that paper, if anyone's interested, is going to be Morgellons Growth Inhibition Confirmed. Then there's a second one, more recent, called Growth Inhibition Achieved. And this, we don't have specific concentrations, but we see in the cultures, not only the vitamin C inhibiting the growth of this cross-domain bacteria and filaments and so forth, but two other things, N-acetylcysteine, which is an amino acid that could be bought at GNC or vitamin shop, as well as glutathione. NAC produces glutathione in your body. So if you were to eat an NAC capsule, it is transferred in your body to glutathione. You can't, unfortunately, eat glutathione. It doesn't work very well. But
they do they do sell it. I just looked it up quickly. It's like a, they do sell it. And I don't know if that's pill form, though, but it sure looks like it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course they sell it. What I'm saying is there's something called bioavailability,
right,
which means that let's say you eat a gram of glutathione. If it has a 1% bioavailability, that would mean that only 10 milligrams would actually reach your blood. But with N-acetylcysteine, if you eat a gram of it and it's got a 90% bioavailability, that would mean, say, 900 milligrams would reach your blood. So... It just means that more of it can be absorbed. That's all it means. So, and it's a precursor for glutathione. It's converted to it, I think, in your liver. So they're promising. Yeah, these are all areas that if we got the right, you know, medical personnel, you know, that and the right resources, that could be explored. And certainly just getting the information out to the public. So that, you know, if somebody wants to pick this up, or, you know, if they have the resources and the ability to do the research and the paperwork and all that goes with it, then we would love to see a study on this. So that's the basic information. So it's not entirely hopeless. We do have indications, thanks to Clifford, on things that inhibit the growth of this stuff, at least in a in vitro environment. So. So it's not entirely hopeless for sure.
Well, that's good. That's a positive note. So why don't we kind of enter into far into some speculation and deep into the weirdness forest here for a little bit? And just, is there anything that in the makeup right now of the CDB that suggests that they can be, how should you call it, remotely controlled?
That's an excellent question. They seem to have properties which indicate they may be paramagnetic, which means that they, well, it has to do with like molecular orbital theory and all this stuff. But that means they're kind of like magnets. So, and there's a good video, I think it's of Clifford using a magnet, and it's repelled by it. And then a couple of minutes later, it's attracted to the magnet. So that suggests that they respond to magnetic fields. So I would venture to say that that's absolutely a possibility and maybe even a probability, because if you think that the system over however long it was built, 20 years, 50 years, they would not have spent, you know, billions of dollars a year, possibly even trillions, maybe 500 billion a year on this thing without giving it that feature. That'd be like buying a car without getting the power doors and the power windows. So,
right.
You know, I would suspect that's in there. And if it's not, that would just mean that they didn't get the technology yet and they're working on it. So I would say if it's not happening now, it will be happening in the future. So that's absolutely a consideration. But besides just very basic evidence, we don't have complex evidence. We have the magnetism thing, and we also have the fact that the culture responds to specific wavelengths of light, electromagnetic radiation. And it also responds to, I believe, electrical current, as well as pulsed electrical current has effects on it in terms of its growth rate and so forth. So, there are preliminary indications of that, but, you know, we're far from the stage where we could, you know, point a microwave dish at it and have it do something. But it's certainly possible that this is connected in with HARP, and that, you know, that they're the electromagnetic waves are being used to somehow control gene expression in this organism. It's possible.
Yeah,
sure.
Now, what do you think the application would be in the field of transhumanism? How would this be used then?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think that if you read, you know, some of the writings of Aldous Huxley and his brother, as well as Bertrand Russell, who wrote The Impact of Science and Society and so forth, and H.G. Wells, they've all been talking about creating, you know, caste systems, like a super elite which has, you know, mental faculties far above the average man, and then the rest of us, the masses who don't. And so I really think that this technology would be used to try to exacerbate the split between sort of the psychopathic elite of this world and the masses of people, and to increase the control and to ultimately control the evolution of the species, and that helps you control the structure of a future society. And not only that, the ability to control things like, you know, growth of plants or animals or what have you, it ties in with the weaponized aspects of weather warfare. You know, with weather warfare, you could induce a drought or a crop failure, or even, you know, tectonic shifts with enough power. But with this, you can not only just induce a crop failure, you could completely change what the crop does. You could turn it from corn into who knows what, you know? So
yeah,
there's lots of applications in that. But I think the big thing was hit on by Sophia in her presentation, which is the idea of the merging of man and machine. And that's kind of, it seems, what's going on with this. And so you have these revolutions in nanotechnology and in biology, as well as computing, as well as, you know, artificial intelligence as it gets more and more evolved, that we may get at a point where you know, any number of dystopian futuristic scenarios are possible, but the you know, I mean, I can't speak to specifics because I'd just be speculating, but think about it like this. This is how I think about it. The application of artificial intelligence to this program, if I were designing it, they have the data on the wind and how things disperse and so forth, and they have various goals. You know, I would say, well, let's build a giant system with aircraft or drones, whatever form they are, which take off and land and are unpiloted, which are told by computer, not humans, where to go spray. And they're pre-programmed. They take off and land by themselves, and they go and conduct these operations. And all the human operator needs to do is program in the objective, whatever that may be. And then the system or the AI, not full AI, but softer AI, is able to take care of the rest to say, in order to achieve this outcome, this population receiving this amount of this particular strain of this organism, you know, with these wind patterns and this storm system and low pressure and high pressure system and this relative humidity and all this, we need to calculate the following flight paths. We need, you know, this many aircraft, and, you know, the system would take care of all of that. So that's how AI might link into this on a lower level. On a higher level, that's an excellent question. And in fact, is one I haven't really thought about until you brought it up in detail, but how AI fuses with this is an excellent question. I wish I had a good answer for you right now, but I don't.
Now, if we think about it, this could be an implementation of a recommendation from, well, it could be something run out of a supercomputer, a simulation or something like that, or even possibility of, you know, an AI really already being in existence. We just don't know about it in that regard. But as it's seeking the information flow and the connectivity, we know about the future scenarios of everything from the surveillance in itself to, you know, the haptic devices and you know, floor panels that feel when you walk on them, and all, you know, when you lean on the wall, I mean, everything is going to be connected, the Internet of Things, and you have all of these things which would literally be the sensory input of an artificial intelligence, so that it could you know, guide, if you will, the full experience, and also in that capacity take full control, right? So this might be on the recommendation of something like that, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a question I wrestled with, considering how advanced this biological or nanotechnological, whatever you want to call it and whatever it actually is, considering how advanced it is, I've considered to myself, there's something in the literature called hard AI. And that's kind of what we're talking about. It's AI that is so intelligent that you can't really take it apart, tell it apart from a human. And that's called a Turing test, invented by Alan Turing, you know, 50 years ago. Yep. But certainly, you know, that's a question, because they've got this secret, you know, spray program, which is obviously an illegal, deep black, you know, unacknowledged wave special access program that's been funded to tune of billions a year. You know, if they've got that, you know, and there's also evidence that they've got electrogravitics, which is a whole nother topic. If they have those things, is it that far-fetched to think they have something like quantum computers? And I'll tell you, personally, I've got evidence linking this chemtrails stuff to the major defense contractors in the national labs. And I know one of the prime suspects, as far as defense contractors goes, is Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin funds all sorts of papers on like quantum biology. And in fact, they were a company called D-Wave, D-Wave, came up with the first quantum computer, and Lockheed was their first customer. And I thought to myself, you know, well, is Lockheed just trying to take the pulse of public research, or do they already have one of these? And I almost think they must already have one. So then the question is, do they have so-called hard AI? Is the singularity already here? You know, that sort of stuff. But it's just, it hasn't been in, it's not quote unquote in production. It's only driving certain things. It's driving, you know, the drones and the spraying and the genetics and so forth, but maybe not, you know, your local television personality on TV, that they're still, you know, talking about whatever the script says, or they go home and exercise free will. Obviously, you and I are exercising free will, so we still have that. But the whole thing with the AI, it's a certain possibility. I'm certain they have some form of it, Whether it's to the point of, you know, quote unquote singularity in the Black programs, I don't know. But that's an excellent, excellent point. And I would tend to agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, Google bought one of those as well, not too long ago. And I mean, also we can think about it in the context of something like the Manhattan Project. That, I mean, how many years was that kept secret before they actually revealed, you know, what they've managed to do? And, you know, again, why wouldn't it be a similar scenario here? And we know how much just tremendous amounts of money going into research and development into new technologies and just the way that they have even being able to keep things off the books. I mean, there's even an official Black budget, if you know what I mean. So there's an right. endless string of funding and finance coming these people's way, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't believe that official Black budget for a second, because we know just based on evidence, I think it was San Jose Mercury News, that the CIA makes money from drug trafficking. We have Iran-Contra. We know yep. they sold weapons for money. So there's certainly drug trafficking and getting and selling weapons for money among whatever else they're doing, you know, counterfeiting it, printing it, whatever. So money is no issue to this. So it could be far, far more advanced from what we know. But one thing I'd like to just bring up for a second, in the earliest visitors, when Clifford first put up his website, there was very high profile visitors to his website, which included companies like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, as well as various pharmaceutical corporations, Monsanto, all sorts of people. And it's just one guy posting some photographs of the sky. And why would they all be interested? So, I mean, that would be a prime suspects list as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, we can look at things like, you know, Lockheed Martin, Los Alamos National Laboratory, Alliant Tech Systems. They make munitions and they do space systems. Raytheon, they're the ones that bought up the HARP patent from E-Systems. Raytheon bought E-Systems, which Bernard Eastland, he's the guy that made HARP. Boeing Aircraft Company. I'm just reading the list of visitors back when Clifford started the site.
Right.
Why would these people be so interested? You know,
here it is. Someone discovered it. Look. Here's the website, you know.
Yeah. You know, the FAA, you know, the Department of the Treasury visited Rockwell Collins, Honeywell, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Ames Research Center. That's an astrobiology research center, the Space Dynamics Laboratory, Merck, TRW, U.S. Navy, Air National Guard, Monsanto. You know, we just have a who's who. Bristol-Myers Squibb, that's another pharmaceutical company. You know, so we have a whole list of a who's who of anybody in the defense world, along with the, you know, that visited the site when it was just one guy posting pictures of the sky. So just for a moment, with that in mind, I'd like to read some stuff I managed to poll on Lockheed Martin. It's a slide presentation. It says, advanced innovation is indistinguishable from magic. And it's from the one particular division. I'll post this on my blog, but some of the slides in here, you know, even that is, it's not a classified slide, but it says, you know, Lockheed Martin, you know, $56 billion in annual sales, 60,000 engineers and scientists, 120,000 employees, and that's just the public ones. But, you know, they talk about, you know, there's a slide, how to methodically bring the future back. And they talk about things like plectics, which is the study of complex adaptive systems. They talk about quantum, neural, mimicry, fuzzy experimentation, you know, algorithms, analytics, experimentation, how to quantify it. And it says industry, academia, and government collaboration to make hard science quantifiable. And another slide that's in this that's fascinating is it says anticipating future careers, Generation Z. So this is from Lockheed Martin. This is what they say the future careers are going to be. Neuromorphic architect, quantum linguist, astronautic geologist, biomimicry analyst, roboticist, quantum biologist, microfluidics designer, crypto privacy engineer, nanocomposite engineer, supraplectologist. And from that, I gather that's the study of AI, from what I can understand, and complex adaptive systems. So that's the careers that they put in their slides. And there's one other thing that was in here that was interesting. They also put under quantum biology, they say, engineer cells and microorganisms to produce in vivo medicine. The next one, model and synthesize self-replicating bacterial cell for use as nanomachinery. And that's exactly what we're looking at as the CDB.
Right.
And they actually list mycoplasma with about a million base pairs, which is approximately, a little smaller, but approximately the size of the CDB we're looking at. So they talk about using these little bacteria as nanomachinery. And so they say things like synthetic biology foundation, bridge between bio and nanotechnology, genome big data, RNA as food and drug delivery. So this stuff, you know, it's out there. It's fascinating. I'll put the slides up if anyone's interested. But you know, it's not like the evidence isn't there. So I just wanted to throw that out there in terms of the visitors, and then you know, with the whole Lockheed Martin, and they're not the only one involved, obviously. But
sure.
To me, it's clear there's a private network behind the military-industrial complex. I don't care what you want to call them. Let's just call them a private network. And then they're being directed and funded by somebody above them. Let's just call them the oligarchy, for the lack of a better term, just so we're neutral as to what we're talking about. And that seems to be the structure of what's happening.
Yeah. It's an assessment to take control and to finally, as you said before, some of the early sci-fi writers, but also the early social engineers had an idea of like, okay, we have the possibility now of using technology and science to our advantage to take final and ultimate control over, you know, the human experience and life on Earth and everything else, basically. And I think they're striving for that, and they're doing everything they can to fulfill that dream of theirs, you know?
Absolutely. That's exactly what's going on. And I know when Clifford gets asked, you know, why are they doing this? His answer, you know, is often summed up in one word, and that is control. And I think that's the best one word answer for why that there is. And I agree with you. I think that this, you know, where this is going is exactly, you know, what you've just described. So, you know, it's just it's probably very old in terms of the objective. Certainly, we know from writings it goes back to at least, you know, prior to 1900, to 1850 to 1900, and probably even before that. So, but, you know, now we have to deal with the reality, and that's, you know, that we've got these visitors to Clifford sites, which include things like NASA's Ames Research Center, which is based on astrobiology, which is the study of life forms outside of this system, you know, of this of the Earth. Why would they be so interested in this guy looking at what the Air Force says are just clouds? You know, why would they be interested in that?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, and I think it's part of an old strife as well for you know, a few humans to seek and try to take control over other human beings. It's just something that's been a constant throughout, you know, human history. And I think it's just a matter of other people kind of stepping up to the plate in that process as well and saying, all right, well, we're not going to allow that to happen so easily, you know, and that's where we're at. And now they're just using different tools. It's not the sword and the shield anymore. Now it's nanotechnology and artificial intelligence, you know?
Absolutely. It's the same thing that's been going on for a very long time in terms of humanity. And I just wanted to throw out, well, you know, more on the topic, just for the audience if they're interested in. My take on it is just that there's in a small percentage of the population have what's called psychopathy. And this isn't like in a movie, but what that means is that they biologically lack a conscience. Like, they literally do not have empathy. And it's not that they just don't want to have it or they don't care, but it's that they, in their brain, they just do not possess empathy. And so there's a great book called Political Ponderology, and it's called A Study on the Origin of Evil for Political Purposes. And it identifies how psychopaths sort of manipulate people around them and get what they want, and they tend to rise to the top. And so that's clearly the situation that we're in. We've got psychopaths with all the money that have managed to get together the scientists and the resources and formulate a long-term plan in order to do this. And yeah, it'll be up to all of us to stop them, you know. And part of that is just to begin by identifying and taking stock of where we're at.
Yeah, no, I know. It's yeah, Andrew Lobachevsky, I believe, wrote that
that's right.
particular book. Yeah,
that's now, great.
if this was the good old West or something like that, you know, these people would have been taken care of by good men a long time ago. But they're hiding behind this sphere of, you know, legalese and a framework of, you know, lawyers and ultimately police and military that are standing there and defending them. So this, it certainly is a predicament that we're in, isn't it?
Right. And part of our task is going to be to have everyone to work together and to sort of establish real leaders and not leaders that they give us to lead us, you know, controlled opposition to lead us in the wrong way. And really that's going to start by everybody looking into themselves, into their own hearts and into the line of good and evil between that divides their own heart, you know, and from there, then we can work outward and decide how we're going to deal with this, you know. But
yeah. Okay, so most of what we've talked about here in the last 10 minutes really speaks maybe against my next point here, but there is another possibility here. How about this being an alien extraterrestrial organism? And I'm not suggesting per se that this is guided by an intelligent, sentient extraterrestrial, although that could be the case as well. But as we know, bacteria survive space. We have things like panspermia. This could be something like out of, you know, the Body Snatchers, if you will.
Sure. Yeah, that's something I've gone back and forth over the years many times. And I have, you know, I still reserve judgment on the issue. Obviously, the visit by the NASA Ames Astrobiology Research Center early in this really it speaks volumes. And whether it's just they had the scientific engineering knowledge or what is the question. Now, part of what sort of led me away from the hypothesis that it's extraterrestrial type form is the presence of DNA in the fundamental organism. And that may just be an artifact of that we're a water-based planet and that DNA is the best. DNA and sugars and proteins are the best, you know, molecular machinery. But to me, that suggested almost a genetic engineering form by humans. But it doesn't necessarily rule it out. And some of the research that I've looked into lately in analyzing this has sort of pointed to the fact that on asteroids, we see amino acids. And amino acids are what make protein. And that's what we're all made of. Your hair is made of protein and, you know, all your skin's made of protein. Everything's made of protein. You're mostly made of protein and water. So if we find amino acids which make protein on asteroids, that really suggests to me that not only has life evolved on other planets, but certainly it's the possibility that complex life has evolved on other planets. And there's interesting chemistry things regarding asteroids, which is that one, I think it's the left-handed version of the amino acids are almost exclusively found, while the right-handed amino acids are not. And on planet Earth, it's all left-handed amino acids. So to find the same form in abundance on an asteroid suggests that there may be a common origin of all life across the cosmos. But you know, and there's other things with this whole thing. I mean, you know, I've seen the STS videos, those NASA videos, and wondered about those.
Yeah.
And I just don't know the answer. Right now, I'm leaning towards that this was engineered on Earth, but I'm certainly not ruling out the possibility that of anything, really. I haven't ruled anything out personally. I think it's certainly possible. And another possibility is that, you know, they created it from some genes may have come off an asteroid that they found or that they went up and fetched, you know, from, you know, near space, near Earth and brought it back and found some, you know, some endospores, which are bacteria, they can survive space travel. So that's a possibility, too. As for whether it was an accidental life form that landed on Earth, I think that that goes against sort of what we know about the structure of human civilization and its history, and that's, you know, the whole psychopaths rise to the top sort of thing. What would their reaction be to this? Well, you know, I suppose you could say that they would probably try to you know, fight it or exploit it, because psychopaths act in their own self-interest. So they would, I don't see them letting this go on as a secret unless it was in their self-interest. So that would be my argument against that it's an accidental asteroid that landed and infected Earth. But certainly we, you know, some of the genes, if there are genes in there, I'm not ruling out that some of these genes were plucked off an asteroid or possibly even something more. But unfortunately, you know, we have to, when we analyze it, we have to use, you know, Earth lab equipment. So
right.
it makes my life easier if it's, you know, more conventional. I wish I knew the answer, but I definitely think there is life in the cosmos and other planets, and there's intelligent life on other planets. And I really don't know how it's involved with this. But, you know, what we're going to do is we're just going to keep plugging away and doing the best we can in terms of getting the scientific facts. And then from those, you know, hopefully we'll be able to figure out as we go, you know, where it came from and what it means, you know. So,
yeah, indeed. No, it's very interesting. I have a couple of more points or questions here for you before we begin to round things up. And one of them would be, if this is the discovery of a new type of organism that none has, you know, indexed or, you know, named whatever before. I mean, this could be something that, on top of everything here, could be taken to someone who could, let's say, you know, verify it as a new version of a life form. I mean, if science was honest and open, this would be, I guess, attributed to Mr. Carnicom, and even maybe naming it after him as a Carnicom, you know?
I have joked about that with him, and certainly if he wanted to do that, we could name it after him. But I certainly wouldn't want to be named, have this thing named after me, just because it's so evil.
Right.
That, you know, I've gone over potential names that are neutral that describe it. It certainly seems to be a new form of life. you know, at some point we're going to have to name it. So we're still working on that, and we'll get, you know, names will emerge over time. For the time being, I'm referring to it, you know, as a xenobiological infectious disease, which would mean xenobiological, meaning that it's synthetic biology, and infectious, meaning that it can, you know, infect another organism, and disease, meaning that it causes negative effects. And to further subdivide that, this xenobiological infectious disease or organism seems to be, for the most part, subclinical, in that you don't notice the symptoms. Like, for example, if you hadn't told me about this, or if I hadn't learned from Clifford, I probably wouldn't have noticed this. And if I was more tired than usual, I would have said, you know, well, I'm not sleeping enough, and not realized maybe it's the pathogen utilizing, you know, energy from my own body. So,
right.
So naming, yeah, we've got to come up with the name for this. And we definitely need more verification, you know. So if there's scientific labs out there, or anyone with access to a scientific lab that's interested in doing independent verification of the science, that is on the up and up and is willing to keep an open mind, you know, then we certainly want to either confirm or disconfirm any of this information. And, you know, we would love for that to happen. So, you know, the more people that are involved, the better. And if we had another lab, you know, in another country like Germany or Europe or somewhere in Europe, whatever, if they start studying it as another organization, and it's done from the ground up with not controlled opposition, but real people.
Right.
That'd be great. And especially if we disagreed, because that would offer us the opportunity to learn more. So I would encourage that. I'd encourage anyone with the scientific knowledge to get involved, either with the Carnicom Institute or on their own.
You know, not that I care much for the official world per se, since they've turned their back on most of reality. But I mean, is there any interest in, since this is something you can see and measure, you know, that this could be, I don't know where you go to get, you know, things to, hey, I have a discovery. I've discovered something new here, you know, kind of thing, to get it more officially recognized, I guess. Is that something in the plant?
It may be. I mean, we have something in the works that we're doing that's quasi-official, which is this Morgellons research project. And, you know, it's sort of in progress, so I don't really want to get into the state of the whole thing. But that's coming up, and that's sort of a quasi-official type of thing. It's, you know, a study that's, you know, I guess it's got some sort of independent, you know, element to it that's outside of us. So that's going to be on the horizon the next few months. So that's something to look forward to. But as far as like going to like, you know, having published papers myself, the problem is that they want specific topics and specific domains, and funding is often cut to scientists that don't toe the line, you know, in the sense that they go off in their own tangent. So it's not like it was, you know, 50 or 100 years ago where everyone, all scientists had a home lab and the breakthroughs came from people that thought outside the box. Now it's like people follow the university course, all the materials are provided, and experimentation is not encouraged until people become very specialized in a specific area. So just the structure of the scientific institution in general makes it difficult. So even if we had the best paper in the world, getting it quote unquote peer reviewed, even if it was perfect, I just have a feeling it would quote, you know, be rejected for whatever reasons. Either people couldn't believe it, or that there was the involvement of covert elements, you know, because obviously you have intelligence networks that are protecting these secrets. So I think the tactic now is, you know, to get the information out, to translate the scientific information into plain English, and to encourage independent replication and have it work from the ground up. And eventually, if enough people do it and it catches on, the mainstream will be forced to pay attention, you know, especially with viral videos and, you know, whatever other tactics we can use to get this through the media. Not the mainstream media, but the alternative media, then, you know, the better shape we'll be in and the more leverage we'll have.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, there's even been some local channels, I think, over in the U.S. that have begun touching now and then on the chemtrails issue and stuff like that. So there's certainly hope for that. Now, one last question for you with, I guess, two parts to it. If one would like to test for this, if this is something that, you know, you have, is there a way to test for it? And if so, if one does have it in them, are there any other symptoms beyond the fibers that has been reported? I don't know, like strange pains or other, you know, bodily or emotional issues attached to it?
Great question. So I'll answer the second part of your question first. And that's, you know, sort of symptoms. That's what we're involved in with this Morgellons research project at the Carnicom Institute, which is, you know, sort of kind of an official type of, I guess, study, really. And you can read more about it on the Carnicom Institute website. And we're working very hard on getting that in order to do some analysis to identify and do some statistical clustering to get at what symptoms may be. Because right now, all we have is anecdotal information, and that's not scientific. We need, you know, actual data analysis. So there are symptom lists available, but we're trying to get some hard data on that. But in terms of like evidentiary things that can be proven that we know, in terms of testing, it, you know, one is the so-called red wine spit test, which is, right, you know, I say approximately, if I remember right, say, let's say 15 to 20 milliliters of dark red wine, like a Merlot or something like that. And then optionally, you can add another 5 milliliters of hydrogen peroxide. It's not essential, but, you know, it can help with the yield. And then swish it around for about 3 minutes, 4 minutes, spit it out into a clear dish, and you can see the fibers in it. And if you let it dry, or, you know, you let it dry and then you wash it with isopropyl alcohol, you can see, and then let the isopropyl alcohol evaporate, you can see that there's tons of material, and it's not food. It's definitely sort of a fibrous material. So that's the first sort of quote-unquote test. The second is sort of an independent project I'm working on, and I'm trying to build a, using the public labs spectrometer, which is a do-it-yourself spectrometer, to let people be able to analyze their own blood and get their blood spectra. And I ran into a bunch of problems with that because being an $80 device, there's really cheap Chinese components and there's problems in the software and algorithms and whatnot. So essentially, that's a project of mine that I hope to be out in the next 6 months, if it's possible, to let people analyze their blood with a, you know, $80 or $100 home-built device as opposed to a, you know, $1,000 to $4,000 professional spectrophotometer.
Right.
So the first test would be the easy one. You can examine them, you know, however you want. You know, you can, you know, magnifying glass or whatever and take a look at those fibers. As for the blood spectra, I'll be posting more about that on my blog soon enough. As I get the components, I'll be analyzing my own blood spectra and that of friends and family, and I'll post all of those results to see if they match to match the Carnicom Institute. And as we go along, I'm going to see if I can get this cheap $80 device working in such a way to produce roughly similar resolution, at least enough to be able to get the rough spectra. But the do-it-yourself spectrometer is available at, I believe, publiclab.org. But don't go buy it yet, because the software is not going to let you analyze your blood yet. Oh. It's not there. So the software needs to be rewritten, and that process is, for me at least, if I do it, is going to take about 3 months, 6 months. So it'll be on my blog if I figure it out. But those are the two diagnostic methods that we know of that you could perform at home.
All right. Well, thanks, Vincent. I mean, this has been tremendously informing and interesting and captivating and kind of bizarre and worrying all at the same time. You're very thorough, and I want to thank you for coming on and sharing all of this with us and talking more about this. Why don't you, as a last measure here, give us the websites again, and of course, if there's anything else that you have upcoming, or, you know, where people can go to support you guys, and also if there's anything else that's next now in the process step here that we could look out for on the website for updates about.
Okay, there's two things. The first is start following the Carnicom Institute. You know, just check out those papers and the website. We have some new stuff in the works with that. And then in terms of my own website, which I just started, I will try to keep it updated with information. So that those two websites are the Carnicom Institute is carnicominstitute.org, I believe. Is that right? Yes. And then my site is biocode.info, and you can go there and I'll be posting updates on my research or whatever. And I'll also put a sticky link on the blog for the donation for this equipment we need, which were the API strips. We do need a lot of other equipment, but I figured we'd start small with the cheapest thing on our list and the most pressing one. But So we want to get more equipment. And then, if anyone is interested in either speaking directly with me, or if they have skills they want to volunteer, I would suggest contacting info@carnicominstitute.org. If you're interested in volunteering, if you have some specific skill that could help with this. And then if you need to contact me directly, you can reach me at Vincent, V-I-N-C-E-N-T, at biocode.info if you want to send me an email.
All right, we'll wrap up on that note as well. I also want to say thanks to Sophia Smallstorm, by the way, for connecting us with you, Vincent. This has been really interesting and really good stuff. And we'll have to have you back in the future, okay? And we'll talk more about what's going on and what's what will be discovered next.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. And thanks again to everyone that's helped, including Clifford Carnicom, of course, and all the staff at the Carnicom Institute, as well as Sophia, for her excellent research and hard work. So, and thanks to you for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, what a bizarre and interesting story. We'll keep an eye on this one and see what can be discovered and learned ahead here. All right, we say thank you for listening for this time. Thank you for your support. And thanks to all our wonderful members who keep us going and makes all of this possible. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Don't miss the latest Radio 314 program with Johnny Enoch on the war on Kratom. We have upcoming on Red Eyes Radio, Ingunn Sigurdsdottir from Norway to break down the myth that Norway is the best country in the world. We have John B. Wells, Catherine Austin Fitz, Chip Tatum with Ulla Damagård, Robert Morningstar, and Zoltan Istvan for a pro transhumanist perspective. That should be interesting. All right, my thanks to the Red Ice crew. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you in just a few days. Take care.